said talk to me, damn it, or else I'm gonna throw you in the fire!
You stupid bitch, you filthy!
Welcome back to Flyover State of Fear. We got me and Brian had an amazing guest for you. We have director.
A real guest.
Don't overdo Kito. It.
Nah, it's that real. Simple. Director it's a real guest. Friday, come on, who we're it. Talking to, a real guest. The last couple of times, it's just been Brian and I and like our friend.
Right on.
How you doing, Casey? I know we've met each other on Twitter for a minute and reached back out and joining us.
Great. I'm glad. I'm happy to do this because when you make a film, you get, you know, you're doing like 10 interviews a day and 15 podcasts in like 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's good to like, you know, I love the Roger Avery Tarantino podcast. And obviously I love the Movie Crypt with Adam and Joe. And I feel like it's always good to re-talk about films or other films. So I'm happy to do it.
Oh, yeah, no, that's, yeah.
Yeah, now you've got a little hindsight. You've had the full experience now. You can talk on it even more. We're ready for that. We love it.
Yeah, for sure. Perfect. For sure.
It's been out a minute. Let it marinate and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So on this show, though, I do like to, before we get into Black Friday and everything, you know, what is, like, your horror origin story? You know, what got you into the genre? I mean,
it's funny. Joe Lynch is a friend of mine, and he's got Suitable Flesh coming out like next week. And you know, Heather Graham, Barbara Crampton, and I love Joe. He's like one of the nicest guys in the world. And he had texted me, and he was talking about Lovecraft. And I'm like, Joe, don't you remember we were literally in the Cross Creek Pictures offices like 5 years ago, pitching like a Reanimator thing. And he's like, oh my God, I totally forgot about that. And I said, you know, we had the conversation of, I had a strange upbringing in the sense that where I grew up in Massachusetts, I didn't get cable till I was like in college, in the mid 90s. And there was one movie theater near us that, I don't know how the distribution system worked back then, but we would get the strangest fucking movies. Like we would get Aliens and Predator and stuff like that, but there was like Treasure of the Four Crowns,
Gnome Named Norm.
I mean, really, all this weird shit. I don't think we were getting like trauma films or anything, but I mean, I do remember seeing Swamp Thing, Toxic Avenger. But we,
for a small theater though, that is something. Yeah, that's like they must have like a private owner.
It was more like a fringe theater for sure.
It's like a preference almost.
But we had this weird thing in the late 80s, which was called Preview. It was this fucking box that looked like an old Atari 2600. What's up? We had this Preview set-top box, and it would get like all these weird channels. This was like in the day of HBO and Cinemax, and you get scrambled porn and stuff like that. And they had the most random movies. And for the longest time when I was a kid, my favorite movie was Band of the Hand, which was like Lauren Holly, Leon, just random stuff. Kentucky Fried Movie and UHF, okay. Hot Dog the Movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
the horror stuff we would get was like Extro and Chud and Ghoulies and Street Trash and
real obscure.
We weren't I was not getting like Halloween or Friday the 13th. We would see those things on VHS for sure, but all the stuff, you know, dude, I grew up like, I would say my dad was a teacher, my mom was a housewife, so we didn't have a lot of money, so we had like, you know, middle class typical American. We were not going to the movies a lot. There was no comic book stores around me. We were not renting movies that much because my parents were not big movie people.
So you're making your own fun.
Yeah. And so we would watch everything on preview.
Well, and you're just at the mercy of what's presented to you. You're like, well, these are my options. This is it.
Literally. It's so wild to think, like, some of these movies you're naming and, like, you know, and everything, that those are in preview and they're just kind of like, here's what's available. And now you have places, which I'm glad they are for, but, like, you know, your Vinegar Syndrome's charging $45 for a copy of Chud or like Street Trash.
Yeah, I don't even want to tell you what Extra on Blu-ray probably costs right now.
And it's like, imagine. Wow, those were the, you know, lack of a better word, the dirt movies for the longest time. And they,
it was that, and it was, if anything was ever on TV, there was two stations in Boston, 38 and I want to say 38 and 56. We would get like Christine, the TV edit. So I would tape that and have to fast forward through the commercials. But it was, and then the big one, I think one of the real jumping off points for me was the original TV series V, which was incredible.
Robert England, oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
So that was, you know, it was stuff like that. And it wasn't until I got into college and I went to college in New Haven, so we would go down to the art house theaters down there and see other movies like Taxi Driver, or because we weren't able to see that stuff.
Yeah, that's when you're like, how it expanded and did everything. I know you mentioned quite a few. Was there any one, I know you said the one Beyond the Hand, that really jumped out and like captured it? Because obviously, when watching Black Friday, I you know, you see a lot of influence from other, you know, of the full spectrum of the genre in it.
I mean, probably, I think the first time I saw, I don't want to call it a horror movie because it's not really a horror movie, but I think the first time I saw a movie that really gave me that holy shit moment as a kid was probably They Live. I mean,
okay. I think it's in the genre. I think so.
And it's funny. I went to see it in the theater at the Coolidge in Boston on the big screen. Somebody had a 35 print, and I forgot the ending was like so obscure. Like they die and then the movie ends. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's not complete almost, but it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So probably They Live. And I think Christine probably too, because my brothers and I used to joke about that movie when we were kids, you know what I mean? So that was something that we watched on repeat a lot too. So probably Christine and They Live, I would say.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I definitely, I was just talking about Christine and like someone was like, it's my favorite Stephen King, Bob. And I, you know, I was on Twitter and I was like, that's so like it, obscure in the pantheon of like, you know, what that is, but it makes sense, and you have that limited value. I know, like, I mean, I'm 31. I grew up in the 90s, you know, 90s as a kid, more 2000s, this and that. But I remember being terrified of talking about trash movies and not realizing until later on. My brother rented Troll 2 probably at the age of 5 or 6, and I saw it when I was 3, and I remembered some imagery and be like, that's horrifying.
Yeah. So,
who's registering that?
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, because without the context of of knowing what a terrible movie is, just some crazy special effect thing can happen, and your little kid brain is just like,
And then 15, and then 12 years later or something, I have that, I don't know if you guys remember, there was a channel called Reels Channel on like obscure cable.
Yeah.
Well, they're highlighting the documentary of that movie, and I'm like, holy shit, that's that memory. That's what I thought was it never clicked. So I totally get the, you know, kind of fallen in love though with the B movie and that, but that's super interesting. Yeah,
like you guys said, I didn't know that those,
you didn't know there's a difference.
Just thought, because, you know, it's funny, Joe has such an amazing knowledge of cinema and B movies, and I said something to him once about Treasure of the Four Crowns, and he was like, I don't remember that. And I looked it up, and it was a Sony Columbia movie. It was a total Indiana Jones knockoff, and it was in 3D. But I never thought, like, oh, this isn't a big studio release. Yeah, I just always thought that movies were movies. I didn't know.
And I would say, honestly, that's relevant to the way media comes out now, because everything's so niche. Like, there's almost nothing that has like the, I mean, I guess there's still, you know, like tentpoles that a lot of people, but like so many people have a favorite thing that like they barely even know anybody else who's seen it. I know that happens to me all the time. Like all some of my time. Favorite movies of the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm like the only person I know who's watched them, you know?
I know. Yeah. I mean, for you, it's The Ritual. For me, it's Cam.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I do that.
So all I had a Christmas time, I got a really strange phone call. So, I, for about 5 years now, I've been super close with the family that owns and operates Cross Creek. These guys make huge movies like Black Mass and Pale Blue Eye. And the dad, Tim, he, you know, these guys, they raise, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to make these huge studio movies. And he called me and he goes, hey, I have a guy who wants to make a movie and I think you guys should connect. And I met this investor, this guy from Texas, who had sold his insurance company for like $900 million. And he's like, I think I want to make a movie. I was like, great, let's hear, you know, what do you want to get into? And he's like, well, I want to tell you about my favorite movie ever. And I think I want to make a sequel and I'll come to Boston and we can talk about it. And the dude flies to Boston. He brings me to this super expensive steakhouse and he starts talking and he proceeds to pitch me for about 30 minutes on Street Trash. And I'm like, dude, I know that movie. Like, I know what you're talking about. You know what I mean?
I'm familiar.
Yeah. So it's just like you guys said, everybody does have their own
weird little
shit that they love. You know what I mean? Which is one of the things that's great about movies in general. You know?
Absolutely. I do that too. I watched Black Friday like when it was released and it was just that, you know, no trailer. Okay, this sounds interesting. Watched it, you know, was into it, moved on. I do still, you know, my wife always comes in and she goes, what are you watching? And half times I go, I don't know the name because I just hit play.
Yeah.
You know, with like Hulu or something like that.
Let me ask you guys a question on that. Because I wanted to say something about this on Twitter, but I don't want to piss anybody off. I usually try to watch a movie a night. That's just my ritual. Like I do my things with my kids and work. And then I usually at night, maybe around like 10, I'll put a movie on. I'll just go on Amazon or Netflix or whatever. And
speaking my language.
That's what I've been doing since. I'm not going to name call anybody or whatever, but the last I watched two movies, I think it was on Tuesday or Wednesday, and I started them both, and like 20 minutes in, I was just like, I can't do it. Do you guys finish no matter what, or do you shut things off?
It, especially in that scenario, because I've kind of been doing the same thing, Casey, I would say on and off since I've been in high school, like movie a day, movie a night, something.
Yeah.
Especially late, I turn it off or I'm asleep by time, you know, it's over with, you know, and if it was interesting in the slightest, I'll go back. But other than that, nah, it's a dud, you know? And for me, a lot of times that happens with those, like, I'll give any movie a shot, especially comedies and horror. You know, those are the ones I think give the longer and then you turn the fuck off.
Yeah.
I you know, it depends. Like if I'm watching a, like a lot of times, you know, I'm same way, movie a night, but I'll look for something like around 90 minutes or, you know what I mean? I'm trying to get something with a tight runtime, that sweet spot. And so unless it's really objectionable and like really just like flat out boring or has something that is just like offensively bad to me, it may not hold my attention, but I'll kind of let it run through a lot of the times. It has to be pretty awful for me to just shut it off. You know what I mean? Especially if it's a short one like that, you know?
Yeah, I'm Googling as you're talking because I had posted something about what was the one frame of film that scared you more than any. And it got like thousands of retweets and like 90,000 replies or whatever. And there were so many horror movies that I hadn't seen. And there was one, I forget the name of it, but it was really fucking good. It was about a young girl, and at the end, she ascended to holiness and God, and then there was like an edit, and for like 4 seconds, you saw that she was actually burning to death on a beach.
I don't know that. No,
that does sound familiar.
That sounds familiar.
It was great, and it's called like Mary Full of Grace or something like that. It was awesome. But there was a lot of movies that people brought up. Like I had never seen like Mungo
and mm-hmm. I watched yeah, that.
Yeah, like, was good. Sure.
It's incredible. And there were so many great.
There was.
We just on our last episode talked about a little movie from 2008 called Splinter. It's a little, it's a magnet films. And that was another, it's like one of those same ones. It just flies under the radar. But I saw it around the time it came out and it just kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, we just go covered back it.
To it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It,
I
like,
think
I would put it in that category. Like,
yeah. One of the things that's frustrating as being a fan of movies is people will always ask me like, what should I see? What should I see? What should I see? Send me movies. Send me movies. And I'll be like, oh, have you ever seen, you know, Amores Perros or City of God or Pan's Labyrinth? And they're like, does it have subtitles? And I'm like, yeah. They're like, I'm not going to watch that. And it's like, my buddy Clay, who's a comic book artist, he works for DC. He's done a ton of work for me. He helps me write sometimes. He has been on this huge Italian movie kick. And he's been sending me all these, like, these race car movies that look like they are straight up just
shooting. Oh, like the Le Mans type.
Yes. Like I had, there was a clip he sent me of a guy, a stuntman, straight up getting hit by a car. Like, this is no joke. Like Tom Cruise doing stunt. This is like the dude really gets hit. And it's like, there are so many movies out there that you just have to dig, you know, or get recommendations from people.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's well, one of the one you mentioned the shot and the first thing that came to mind is I covered it on the show, actually, and part of the reason why I started the show was to expand my, you know, knowledge of movies. So I love when someone doesn't just say, hey, I want to talk about, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street or something.
Yeah, right.
But we talked about this movie on Shudder called Caveat with, I don't know if you ever saw it. I think it's an Irish film, if I remember correctly. But there's one frame, and actually the woman I had on put it as her background, and I wasn't paying attention. And it scared the shit because it just really like a slow burn. It was like
one got me again in real.
It got me in real life, and there's a reaction. Wow. So, but no, that's awesome. I love that question though, because yeah, what is that single shot? I know for a lot, like the cliche answer. One of my favorites is, you know, Exorcist 3, the big jump scare of the nun.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. But Casey, moving on just a little bit. Before we begin, and actually I'm going to do a little different this time, I like to read the synopsis from Google blindly. Sure. But this time I want me to read it, and I want you to tell me if this is accurate to Black Friday or not, and then we'll just dive into the, you know, our questions.
You feel like Google appropriately assessed your
Because I have no idea who writes these things, you know, on any of these sites.
Probably an AI.
I was going to say, it's even a person now an AI. Anymore. Who knows, now an AI. Right?
Yeah.
all right, so... Let's begin. On Thanksgiving night, disgruntled toy store employees begrudgingly arrive for work to open the toy store at midnight for the busiest shopping day of the year. Meanwhile, an alien parasite crashes to Earth in a meteor. This group of misfits, led by store manager Jonathan and longtime employee Ken, soon find themselves battling hordes of holiday shoppers who have been turned into monstrous creatures hell-bent on murderous rampage on Black Friday. I would say that's one pretty of good. The most accurate ones we've ever read.
Pretty good, yeah.
I started reading them because I was always surprised. It was like, I think it was Scream, and it was like, iconic movie by Wes Craven, you know, starring, and then just listing the names, and I was like, trash.
It wasn't a description at all. It was just a...
yeah, so I would say that nails the description, and... meant to say this while we begin, I'm just going to be calling, I don't know your characters' names that well, so
yeah, no problem.
This person.
I'm not worried about it.
Luckily, the cast is full of iconic people whose names I do know. We can always refer to them by those names.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go. Well,
Andrew had a character named Brian, which was helpful for me.
the first thing I noticed, immediately was your core cast, except like two people, all had some horror roots.
Yep.
You know, I mean, down to you know, Christopher with his being from the Goosebumps. I'm a sucker for the Goosebumps movie.
Yeah, they're great.
And I was like, oh shit!
I didn't realize he had grown 3 feet. You know, I knew the dude looked familiar, but I could not place him. And Joe told me that, and I was like, ah, he's just a tall man now.
Yeah, he's also the Tom Petty kid from This Is 40.
Yes, that I remember. Okay. Melissa McCarthy.
His first movie was Super 8.
Yes. Yes,
I haven't seen Super 8 since it came out.
I've had a bit of a, oh shit, yeah, that's Champion and the Tom Petty kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, so how did this kind of come about? Because I noticed, you know, I was curious of like, you know, you're the director of the movie, but it was written presumably by someone else and everything. So how does that start?
I try to read a couple scripts a week, and there was a website called Virtual Pitch Fest, and they reached out to me and they were like, hey, would you know, help us out, read scripts. I think they pay you like $1 a script or something. And I was like, yeah. So people send you a log line and a synopsis, and if it's cool, you read it. And I had read tons and tons and tons, and some are great. You know, there was, it's like The Blacklist, you know, you just go through and you read all these scripts. And Andy had sent me, I had read Andy's, and I thought, okay, well, this is something that if I was 12 years old, I would want to see this movie, you know? So my sons at the time, I think, were 13 and 11. So
it's perfect age.
Yeah. Perfect age to make a movie for them. And, you know, as far as the casting goes, I don't know, man. I'm seeing movies get made now, and one of the things that bothers me about filmmaking a little bit is, like, I heard Tarantino talking about how much he loved Enemy of the State, and he was talking about how much he loved, I think it was Seth Green and Jamie Kennedy, or Seth Green and a couple other supporting players.
Oh, yeah, they're in Enemy of the State.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, never mind, it's Gene Hackman and Will Smith, but when you have those great supporting actors, and what bothers me sometimes is I see these films getting made and the supporting actors, and I don't, this is not a diss to anybody, I don't mean it like that, but like, you see these movies getting made and it's like one guy and then like eight people, you have no idea who they are. And yeah. I'm like, I honestly think if you reached out to more known actors and tried to, you know, because dude, like, we all love what we do. So I remember somebody said to me once, like, how the hell did you get Michael Jai White in the movie? I was like, we had one role left. And I reached out to somebody at Gersh and was like, hey, do you think Michael would do this? I think Michael was only shooting for like 5 days.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised when he ate it. This makes more sense.
Yeah. I knew not to give it away, but just my horror senses were like, okay, with these three guys, you know, Bruce Devon Sawa, and one of them can't last the whole, you know what I mean, one of them's got to be the guy. I just didn't know who it was gonna be, you know what I mean. I'm like waiting around, pins and needles, like, who's about to get got.
So we you know, most of the cast, Bruce Devon, Ivana, Ryan, Michael, Stephen Peck, who that's, you know, his first movie.
Part of which one was Stephen Peck?
He played Brian, the manager, who
gets, oh yeah, yeah, he was great.
Yeah.
Fucking that turn, I bit him.
Yeah, it's great. I think it, you know, it's a, I think it's a combination, like, so with Devin and Bruce, Devin called me and said, hey, I watched your first, my first movie was a little $500,000 indie called Happy Birthday.
Okay.
And he called me and he was like, I watched your movie. I thought it was great. You clearly know what you're doing. So I'm in. And then Bruce, when we got to Bruce, you know, when you cast a movie, there's a list of people like who's available, who's looking, who might want to do a movie like this. And Bruce, I never thought we would get Bruce Campbell. Mm-hmm. And he called me and he was like, Mr. Tebow. And I'm like, yeah, he's like, I watched your first film, had some great stuff. You know, I know what it's like to make an indie film. He goes, I'm happy to do this movie. He goes, I have two requests. He goes, one, if we're rehearsing and some guy is fixing a light, I'm not going to be happy. And two, I'm not playing Ash. And I was like, well, I think it's clear from the character.
Oh, it's not. My early note of mine was like, I wonder who... not even just dressed him up, like came up with his persona and look and character, because it is so different.
Well, that was a combination of, you know, Andy wrote it. There were a couple of people we talked about, you know, we had a list and it was like, Michael Rooker and
I can see that.
who's the cat who played Shooter McGavin?
Chris McDonald. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, we had
both of those are bangers.
They fit right incredible. In. I mean,
and Bruce was on there, and Bruce was like, you know, I'm thinking like have like this terrible 70s, 80s leftover mustache and like sweater vest. And, you know, Campbell was very, and a lot of the stuff he says towards, because Andy's first draft was much darker in the sense of like, Jonathan didn't really have any sort of like redemption. Mm. And, you know, I said to Andy like a week before we were shooting, I was like, dude, like this is Bruce Campbell, like let's give him something to do. Like let's give him something that the audience loves him. And the whole redemption thing where he's on the roof talking about how people you work with, the retailer family, and like Bruce and I ended up writing that together like the night before we got it, because I just wanted something. I wanted people to leave the movie going, oh, well, that guy, he turned it around. You know what I mean?
He did. He did.
But that's, you know, when we, before you guys started recording, one of the issues we had, at least I think we had, is I don't really care about what people think of the film. People love it. I think that's great. People hate it. I think that's great too. My son, my 13-year-old, is obsessed with Dead Meat. And the guy from Dead Meat, Janice, did a huge video review, and he some of the things he liked, but he mostly didn't like the movie. Mm. And my son texted me with like a sad emoji, and he's like, oh, he's shitting on the movie. And I was like, dude, I don't care. Like, he has like millions and millions of viewers. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I tweeted at him.
People who are going to hear about the movie who are
going
to
hear it.
Like,
and yeah. There's one thing the horror community especially likes to do is hate watch.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, or ironically watch. And
yeah. So Janice, I do it. He tweeted about it, and I said, hey, I'm sorry you didn't jive, and thank you so much. And he was like, oh, dude, no, I liked it. You're so grateful. And I was like, why would I be mad? Like, you have a huge platform. And mm-hmm. and one of the issues we had, and I talked about this with Bruce, was, and I don't think you can really buy into Rotten Tomatoes too much anymore, because
no.
like, you get movies like Home Alone and it's fucking like 52%. Like,
I think what's for, and this is just as outside, I look at it as like, we all forget too, it's just such an aggregator.
Yeah.
You know, no one's, it's a barometer if you want to spend your money, I think, to the theaters, and it's gotten lost of what the actual piece means.
Opinion. The critics was good. It was like New York Times, great review, mm-hmm. bloody disgusting. But a lot of the audience ratings were down, and Andy and I would talk about it, and we would look at reviews and stuff, and none of it ever bothered me. But a lot of the people were saying, like, what the fuck? Where's Ash? Like, this is bullshit. I got ripped off. This isn't what I signed up for. I'm like, Bruce Campbell's an actor. He's not Ash Williams. Like,
right, you know what he means, and though? God, isn't there enough Ash? Like, you haven't just seen him play Ash enough times? Like, give him a chance. I actually was just thinking when I was watching it, when you take a moment to have some really great character stuff with Devin Sawa and stuff, and it was like so many action comedies, especially. You kept the runtime very, very tight still, mm-hmm. and managed to still have some really great character stuff in there. And it felt like I was almost like, oh, wow, they really, I've seen so many where we would just breeze by this for get in another like special effect kill or something. Yeah, we wouldn't have bothered with having a conversation between these characters and actually like, breaking down something about them and learning something about them to care about them. That's so, I hate to say rare, but it kind of is. It kind of is sometimes. Yeah.
Well, it's a real human moment, because I think at the end of the day, you know, Andy worked at a Toys R Us, and I think the movie, people think it's a horror movie, and it is, but it's like, the movie's really about how bad it sucks to work in retail. You know what I mean? Like,
it's the horror of spending your life at minimum wage.
Yeah, that's truly, and I think that it's funny too, because Devin and I have become really good friends, and he and I are working on doing another movie together.
Oh, very cool.
It's so, like, just, it's so, there's so much despair and seriousness and just pathos. It's just, it's really, like, because I think he has the chops. You know what I mean? He's such a great actor, and he's had such a great resurgence. Because a lot of people that were child actors, they kind of try to make a comeback, and it just the audiences don't go for it.
I mean, him and Chucky.
Love that he had a clip of the Chucky curse in the movie. I was cracking up about it. And I was like,
oh my god, Don Mancini, what a sweetheart! I was like drunk in New Orleans and emailed him, and I was like, dude. And he was like, yeah, man, whatever you
need. That's amazing.
He seems like the absolute coolest. Like, everything about that I've ever seen or heard or interview or anybody who's worked with him. Like, you know, you get a vibe from people where it's like, the behind the scenes, the stuff is just smiley bullshit because we have to play nice. But when it's legitimately people are like, and you can tell that people legitimately like Don Mancini.
The one of the compliments of the movie, too, and I know it's usually, like, taboo to say, oh, the runtime and everything. You pulled the Child's Play 2 off. Kind of Brian's like, is this perfect? Under 90 minute, but like,
I was the moments say, I, where I, it's I, a. We harp on it on the show almost movie. Too much, but how like.
Like, how, you know, it's the care and the tight
horror movie can be, and like how like the art of the 90 minute runtime is like slowly being lost. And like,
I agree.
It doesn't mean you're losing anything. It's about pace and it's your about pace. Storytelling. And it's just like,
we break from the chaos to have Devin Sawa's moment of like learning not just
character beats if there's not you're not and, like
apologies
it can be done.
Apologies once again for lapsing on everyone's name. The woman from Pan's Labyrinth and her who's like
Ivana.
Yeah, finding out like, that's kind of what I put together. But getting that it's like no, she's like I'm just messing around because I'm, 22 or whatever. I don't take you seriously. And it was so funny. And this is gonna make me sound like such a jerk off, but this was in high school. So and like sophomore year of high school,
self aware.
You have the thing where she's like, he's like, I took you to breakfast. Like she don't take me out. I remember this was one girl and was like, I don't know, we'll go to this diner that no one goes to, just because I was trying to be a 15-year-old boy and not bring this girl around. And she's like, okay, And every time I think, I'm like, oh god, it's such a scummy move.
Yeah.
But that's what that reminded me of. Like, yeah, we went out. What do you mean? And it's like this place no one fucking goes to.
Yeah, there's an awesome moment I love when they first, the beginning of the movie, she's like putting garland up or whatever. And they first start talking. And he's like, hey, you want to go get pancakes? And she like immediately pulls out like a screen wipe and starts like wiping down her computer because it's just kind of icky. What I mean? Like. Just subtle, awesome acting and blocking that, I think works for that scene.
No, it's neat. Did you guys like get into, I know what you're trying to tell me, like it's a movie about how retail sucks. Did you guys get into just like people's like hell stories of Black Friday? I know you like, there's a script already made and everything, but is that something you would handle as a,
like actual director? Stories?
Yeah, just like real notes, because the movie does a fun thing. I like the setup, like the horror movie, and it's a zombie movie. It's a demonic. I'm referring to it as, I don't know if you have a name for your creatures. I refer to it as a demonic zombie movie, basically.
Yeah, right? I always loved the idea of. Just not typical like zombies kind of sloshing around. Because they're consumers, I love the idea of vultures. That's why they kind of have that like sort of bird.
Yeah, they
look
turn into. Yeah. Well,
I wanted to ask, was that something because I think the look is so fun and I like the idea of the aliens. I mean, I was thinking as I was watching it, I can't remember a memorable alien zombie type movie, like outbreak movie, since maybe like Planet Terror. I was really vibing with that. Was that something that was in the original script? Is that something you brought to it so that to like was that something you and Andy worked on together because you had an idea for the special effects?
Andy's original script was much more it was much bigger in the sense of his imagination. Mm-hmm. Like, he had the monster at the end, but the creatures inside went from like infected to like infected with tentacles to like infected with tentacles, but now it's a spider, a giant human spider, to the ending was like a tentacle spider, you know. And I early on had sent Andy a sketch. Let me see if I can find it. Mm-hmm. It was, I said, Andy, you know, these are consumers. What if we did something that was more like a vulture? And I sent him a sketch, if I can find it. Oh, here it is.
Cut up.
This was the mock-up I did in Photoshop that I don't know if I can.
Oh, yeah. No, I see it. It has a very.
Yeah, absolutely. That's cool.
It has a very, like, Baraka in Mortal Kombat look to it.
Yeah, like a beak where it's two, where the mouth is two pieces. Yeah.
So
Andy was very wonderful to work with. And, you know, I'm sure he probably ate a lot of his pride just as far. Look, it's Andy's movie. He wrote it. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of stuff that we changed. And I'm sure that's for some writers, that's difficult. For some writers, they don't give a shit. You know what I mean?
You know what we're yeah, I can imagine, but it's great to hear, you know, it's collaborative in that, because it is a good end product. And it's funny when you're mentioning it, though, and we're talking about it, I didn't think about this at the time, is the census core of everything reminds me of that one episode of South Park where the Walmart is the heart. And do you guys remember that one?
I think so,
anyway, it's the same. I hate to use that as my...
No, South Park's fucking classic.
But it's literally the same concept of everyone being attracted, right? They're all being attracted to the center nucleus of the alien. And the creature is like with the creature design though, and the alien and the blob sense of it. Yeah, it looked great because I noticed you had Kurtzman on it, and I have a weird connection here. Or a weird like I guess trivia knowledge or whatever. So I noticed you had Robert Kurtzman's son in the movie.
Yeah, Louis. He played Emmett.
Louis, yeah. One of the first people to die. One of my other kind of favorite movies, I think, of the same budget or whatever you want to call it, is Funhouse Massacre.
Oh, yeah. I think our producer, Warner, I think that's his movie.
Okay, that makes sense because when I noticed it, the thing about that movie and when I covered that movie is that he's someone who gets decapitated in that, because it was only because Kurtzman was like, hey, if you want to save a little money, my son can be in it. And I have his cast.
We did that.
That's literally what I was like.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is the connection here, because
he
looked familiar, but it wasn't from Funhouse Massacre. I think he just has one of those faces.
Well, in Louis' defense, too, when Bob brought that up to me, I was like, yeah, it's a great idea, but if he sucks as an actor, like, well, it's not going
to
happen.
Yeah. If he didn't, you need him to be able to do it.
I watched all his tapes, and he was great.
He was a good first
foil. To me, he seemed like the perfect type of actor in that role. Like, he didn't feel out of place or anything to me at all.
Yeah.
I was getting such, in that scene, right before I think he gets bit or whatever, I was getting such anxiety that they weren't going to cut Chris off. Out of the chair.
So
aggressive. I mean, just like to wire tie him and, you know, you're under citizen's arrest. And then I was like, are they going to cut? Like, everyone's ignoring him. And it was like, it's that like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, because at that point, you don't know who, like, you don't know who's going
to
eat.
Well, like, we're a little ahead. We know something. We know he shouldn't be tied to that chair. We're in the place where we're like, he doesn't need to be tied to that chair.
But, yeah, I mean, and was there a further conversation, though, of, you know, is this a, what holiday does this land on? Is this a Thanksgiving movie? Is this a Christmas movie? I mean, it's a combination of both. It's probably, it's a palate cleanser. I'm probably gonna, you know, add it to my rotation of in between.
I think it's a thanks. I think it's a. I mean, Thanksgiving and Christmas have kind of blurred together at this point. Yeah. It's just the American consumer holiday season, you know.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think not to be you know, easy on it, but it's a Black Friday movie. I mean, it's you know,
it's its own holiday.
Yeah, it's literally the day after Thanksgiving. You know,
we'll put it this way: the NFL is now having a Black Friday game this year. Like, I'm a big Jets fan, and I'm
gonna, sorry.
Yeah, no, we're tired. I mean, we've been. I'm waiting for the.
He knows.
I know. I'm waiting for the ceiling. You know, the floor to fall out. Like I have like, but they're doing a Black Friday game this year to bring it to that, and like with Rodgers, tickets are so fucking expensive that that is actually the most affordable one.
I can imagine.
Anyway, but yes, it's just its own holiday now, and I was kind of wondering that, right? Because that's like, I feel like in the last, let's just say 10 years, that's been the new thing of, you know, this is the Christmas movie, you know, the oldest
thing. Like, you find the right sweet spot, you'll have a whole genre of fans who will watch it every year. They'll make it part of their rotation. Well, you know what I mean?
That's what we've heard the last couple of years.
You
get in
on that, you find your... Oh. I mean, I'm that guy. I was that guy before it was a thing. I was the guy watching Groundhog's Day on Groundhog's Day before. Yeah. You know what I mean? And people were like, what? And I was like, I celebrate privately, okay?
Of course, of course, like, ironically, like, you know, I was lucky enough to meet Chris Columbus and his producing partner, Michael Barnathan, who has made almost every one of Chris's movies since.
So, yeah, and between the two of them have put out some, like, iconic movies, for sure.
I think, I don't know what Chris's first directing movie was. But Michael's produced all Christmas movies. But anyway, they reached out to me after Black Friday and were like, "Hey, what are you going to do next?" And I was like, "I'm not sure." And I want to do something big for my next movie. I don't want to stay at the same level as Black Friday because I feel like when you make smaller movies like that, you can get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I'm telling you this is because, of course, it's a fucking Thanksgiving movie. You know
of course.
I
mean? Well,
so,
you know.
Like, but here's the fucked up thing about that, okay? So I do – Black Friday's done. So I'm hoping that this next movie is going to be my next movie. We were literally casting it when the strike started. And it's a Thanksgiving movie. Ironically enough, my birthday is November 22nd, and it's fall on Thanksgiving probably like 10 times in my life.
Damn,
so go figure.
Yeah.
Go figure.
That's yeah. your time to shine,
I'm always on the lookout for movies to watch on Thanksgiving. There's not very many.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving is kind of a hard watch.
That's a hard watch.
For Your Consideration, the Christopher Guest movie, I think counts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Planes, Trains is the obvious one.
Oh, it's and one then, of the best ever.
But I mean, I'm always looking to like fill another spot. So now I got Black Friday and hopefully your next one too. I'll be like, myself a little marathon.
It's an incredible movie. The writers are just it's definitely top tier shit, you know, so fingers crossed we get it done,
hopefully. Yeah, it gets stunning and can't wait to see it.
Get back to work.
Yeah. If you need a lazy podcast cameo, I mean, like, we're your guys.
Sorry, it's not 2018. We're not killing podcasters in horror movies anymore.
No, or I'm kidding. Any movies. Yeah, yeah, that was
a big
trend.
We jumped past that. We missed our sweet spot for that.
We did. So with Thanksgiving now being your holiday, basically you're now into that.
I'm staking my claim.
I know you don't want to get typecast in that. I mean, what's the top tier dish? I mean, I'm still gonna keep going with the movie, but what's the top tier dish?
Thanksgiving?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you got to go with all the classics. I'm a big fried turkey fan.
Fried turkey, okay.
Green bean casserole.
I was going to say green bean casserole.
You know, because turkey, listen, I'm a huge food guy. I've traveled all around the world. I've eaten cuisines from everywhere. Turkey, like, on Thanksgiving kind of sucks. It's kind of dry. It's kind of bland. It doesn't have good staying power unless you make sandwiches. But I think you got to go with the classics, which is the turkey, the stuffing, the cranberry. The
canned cranberries.
Yeah, I love that shit.
Put some stank on that trash of the canned cranberries.
Yeah,
we got a small family, do a small gathering, so I've been doing like a breast turkey breast from the Honey Baked Ham store.
There you go.
Not my mom. My mom does a big one, has gotten bougie, and she's been getting like a farm-raised organic turkey last few years, yeah. And it is not dry. It's more. Oh, it's you know what?
Well, there you go. So, I will say I'm not a big fan of like people that do like the full prime rib on Thanksgiving. No, like, save that for Christmas.
Yeah. I remember someone's girlfriend or whatever was like, talking about cranberries. That's my big thing of like, they need to be the jelly canned. Someone's girlfriend or something was like, I'll bring them. And then talking about bougie, she brought like the fancy, and I was like,
oh, like the chutney?
Yeah, we don't want this.
That stuff sucks.
Get this out of my Thanksgiving. Anyway. Well, that brings me back just to try to do a segue back to the movie a little bit. The part that I was actually grossed out by the most was the giving out. It was a sweet moment of the
turkey
slice, the cold cuts.
It's so slimy and gross.
I was like, oh.
Yeah, and Ivana like smelled it, which is like incredible.
That was
she's handling it too much. Why are you don't fold it for them?
I buy the same like turkey. Like I don't want to be bothered in the cold cut line. So I just buy
the thick cut. It was real moist,
dude. Looking. And like what's so funny about that scene too is like fucking on set. Devin and Bruce were like digging into that turkey, and I turned and looked at Campbell, and I was like, Bruce, like what the fuck? And he turned and looked at me. He goes, hey, it's fucking acting. And I was like, oh my God, man. Like, so gross.
The method where you perform cold cuts.
And that's the nucleus of the fucking movie, though, right? Yeah. That sit down in the back room.
Yeah, so great.
You know what it made me think of? This shouldn't seem it reminded me of the scene in Breakfast Club when they're sitting
literally what Bruce would say when he was doing press.
I was like, when it actually legitimately got to that emotional beat, I was like, wow, they nailed, like, mm-hmm. They didn't just reference it. It didn't just feel like the scene, they got there. And I was really impressed by that. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a great scene. Love that scene.
The other thing I picked up on too is the defective teddy bear, which was such a funny beat. Seth Green, how'd that kind of come about? Because I did hear, when you know it, you're like, all right, that's Seth Green. But then there's moments where I'm like, I'm hearing Chris Griffin, you know, like he does it. Like I think when it's going down the low octave of defective.
As he's starting to kind of melt down a little bit.
It's the Buffalo Bill, you know, Chris Griffin of,
God, 2011 or 12, I was asked to direct this huge Aerosmith music video for G.I. Joe Retaliation. And Paramount spent like hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we made this huge video and all this G.I. Joe shit, and the video came out great. And Joe Perry from Aerosmith was like, that's the best video we've done since like the 90s or whatever. So, of course, my ego is like fucking through the roof. Yeah. And I get a call I'm editing in a hotel room in LA. The next morning, management calls me and they're like, Paramount has pushed the movie 6 months until February. And I was like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. I was so mad. I was so mad. They're like, well, what are you going to do? I was like, I'm going to fucking call I didn't even know Seth. I'm like, I'm going to fucking call Seth Green and have him redo all the G.I. Joe shit with Robot Chicken. And like, I don't remember how I got his number, because Seth and I have been such good friends since that day. I got in touch with him. I think I asked management to reach out maybe. And he and I just we're both huge G.I. Joe fans. Huge G.I. Joe fans. We were getting into like characters that nobody knows. And
some real deep cuts.
Oh yeah. We remember Seth and I are the same age, and we just remained friends. And then I helped him produce his directorial debut, Changeland, with Mac and Brecken Meyer and Seth's wife Claire and Brenda Song. And Seth and I just remained friends. And then we were doing Black Friday, and I don't want to be the guy who's like calling people but like Steven Tyler was in my first movie. He played like this drug dealer who throws
coke. Okay, very cool.
Mexico. But what I'll never forget, when I was making my movie, I called Steven and I was like, can I sleep on your couch for like 3 months? And he was like, why? I'm like, I'm doing my first feature. And he's like, well, what the fuck? You're not going to ask me to be in it? And I'm like, you're an enormous rock star. Like, why would you want to be
in it? And that's what he was like. And he was like, yeah, I'm an enormous rock star. Why don't you ask me to be in your movie?
No, but I think it was more about like the brotherhood and the camaraderie of like, hey, you're making a movie. I want to do that too.
That's awesome.
So I think I texted, because I have asked Seth to do shit before and he just straight up ignores me. You know what I mean? So
well, see, there you go. You don't have to feel bad.
Well, this was his way.
You know if he doesn't want to do it, right?
This was his way of being like, I could have starred in Ted.
Yeah, yeah, right. No, I just texted him and I was like, hey, we have this teddy bear and the lines are really funny. And he called me and he was like, he's like, all right, so I'll just go to the studio and you and I can do a Zoom. And, you know, how did this all play out? And then he and I totally cerebrally went on this tangent, which was like, okay, what if the guy who was like recording, because there was a teddy bear, I think in the 80s or 90s called Teddy Ruxpin, yep. And I think it talked. We were like, what if Teddy, what was that?
So you put the tape in it. Yeah, it talked.
What if the guy who did Teddy Ruxpin lines, like, was having the worst day of his life.
It was like getting a divorce.
The engineer, yeah. And here's the joke. The engineer in the studio was like, press record. Instead of him going like, I'm having a great day. You're my friend. And then, like, then he stopped pressing record. And the guy was like, I'm getting a fucking divorce. Like, he recorded all of the odd parts of that guy in the booth.
Yeah.
I were dying laughing at that. And like, nobody got it. Maybe they did. Maybe some people did. But Dour Dennis, the doll, is Seth's, and they went and made all
Dour
these
Dour Dennis. Okay,
they didn't have a choice. They were like, all the bears are made. Well, let's call it Dour Dennis.
Yeah,
for kids who have depression or whatever. Like Seth and I were dying, and I was texting Andy, and he's like, "Dude, I'm crying." So it's left it in.
It's a running bit that really works, especially when we get Sawa alone with the doll or the teddy bear.
He's already at his lowest point. He's already been like had it knocked out from under him, and now he's got Dour Dennis to partner up with. It's so funny.
Exactly.
And with that, I was kind of also wondering, one of my notes I was trying to, you know, I said to write more questions for you and stuff is what are Sawa's roller skating skills actually like? Was this, you know,
they were actually pretty good, because in the original script, I think Andy wrote it was one of those ripsticks, which are like impossible to use.
I will break my ankles. I do not understand. Those are those two that go like this, right?
I'm pretty sure Devin tried that and he texted me and he was like, dude, I can't do this ripstick thing. It's impossible. So I think I texted Andy and he was like, well, let me just do a rewrite for the roller skates. And Devin was great on the roller skates.
Okay, I was wondering. I was just like, I figured there wouldn't be like an over exaggerated or whatever of a stunt crew there. So I was like, what does the actual roller skate look like when he's off?
Devin was pretty adamant.
Hands on, right? Devin Sawa is an underrated physical actor performer, I think.
Yeah, the only time I really saw him get, I don't want to say mad on set, but he was perturbed, was when he gets thrown through the wall, he was really pissed that we didn't use him because the unions wouldn't allow him to do that. But he really wanted to do that stunt and he was like ready to go. And I think the producer had to step in and be like, dude, we can't throw you through a wall. It's just, you know what I mean?
It's too risky. That makes sense.
I think for guys like Tom Cruise or whoever who do their own stunts, there's like protocols to that.
I read all the time. It's like
insurance bills, I'm sure.
Yeah,
too,
exactly.
Like,
but
a movie with your budget's the not amount of like put your star at risk like that.
Yeah. Devin is probably the least prima donna type of actor. I mean, that dude will straight up do anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This other movie that he and I are we were trying to do it last year. But we needed to raise a little bit more money. It's very dark and very disturbing. And he was like, yeah, like, let's do it. Like,
let's
do it. Devin is a great guy. He's an incredible team player. And he's you know, always about whatever works for the movie, you know.
And I think he's primed to do a role like that. Like, you know, anybody can break out with the right, you know what I mean, and get seen in a different light if the project works, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
I think he's got enough name value that people would give him a chance, and if the movie's really great, he could really break out in it and,
yeah,
then, like, open a new door, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the movie that we're putting together, it's, I guess the short pitch would be, like, it's almost like a No Country for Old Men, but there's, like, a very small fantasy element to it. There's, like, a MacGuffin that turns his character completely fucking insane, and it's really just about, you know, sort of what power can do, how power corrupts men, and it's
gotcha.
Really dark. Yeah, it's really dark and disturbing, and he was like, yep,
I'm in. Hope to see it one day.
Yeah, we'll get it made. We just, yeah, you know, the strike and all that other shit.
Exactly.
So
everything in its own time.
Yeah, exactly.
What else we got? I don't know. I feel like I'm running through everything I just found most cool of the movie. you know, I first and foremost, I know there's some CG, and I know before our conversation we were talking about, you know, AI and CG and stuff like that. Mm. What was the effort, I guess, or the way, especially knowing your B movie background of keeping it as practical as we can? What was that? Because it is very apparent of like the practicality of a lot of the effects, and you know, when we reach the ending, right, and there's the monster that they're shooting to at the sky or coming from the building.
Any movie, you know, you're in good hands when your movie ends with a kaiju in it.
Yeah,
it
reminded
hell
yeah, me.
We're in the right spot.
Even the kaiju part, it reminded me so much of, maybe because I just watched it like not too long ago. Speaking of underrated movies, the movie Colossal.
Oh yeah, incredible!
Oh,
right,
Colossal.
like
oh,
the
you
ending.
Know what was another big one of mine when I was a kid was Crawl. I saw that probably 100 times. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I never, in no disrespect to anybody, you know, Gunn is now running a studio, but I read an article where he was like, I'll never do practical blood. Like, and I get it. It's a lot of cleanup, and you got to reset everything and you got to fix the actors, but it looks like shit. I'm sorry. You know, I was watching, I was watching one of the Resident Evils or something, and it was, or maybe it was a Rodriguez movie, and I love Robert to death. And he's always been very nice to me. But I saw something with CGI blood, and I was like, this looks fucking awful, man. It looks awful.
Yeah, it's rough.
So
I've not improved CGI blood very much.
It's when done okay, it's pretty fine, but it needs to be mixed.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, with a guy like Kurtzman on staff, with all his talents, you want to, and you want to have that sort of old 80s B-movie kind of, you want it to be tangible, you know what I mean? You want it to feel like it's actually there. There was the ending crumbling of the building with CGI, and there was also some composites on the roof.
Yeah.
Which I wasn't crazy about those because, you know, I
when it was you're talking about when it was, I think it grows up onto the roof. And
yeah,
then,
some of the compositing on that was not great. I think we were literally running out of money.
No, it makes sense. And you know what's so silly to me of, you're talking about earlier with like, you know, reviews and things like that. And some of the movies we've mentioned today, right, of your street trashes, chopping malls, this and that, you know, people be like, oh, it was amazing, this and that. And it was like, I wish movies like yours, My Friday, which is clearly an inspiration, would get that same look at from an audience member and credit, because if those movies were made today, people would be having the same review and reverence when it's like, no. Yeah. You're just moving your ages around and having some like nostalgia glasses on when there are so many of that. So having that little like I hope it doesn't come off as insulting. The composite shots you talk about on the roof, I found that by the time it was end of the movie and knowing I'd be talking to you, more so charming and have an understanding of like how movies are actually made too. Than putting it as
I was thinking as when you're getting into the end, you're getting into the climax, and there's some things I felt like we'd already seen. There'd already been like lots of great practical makeup, lots of great creature effects. I like the kind of like pink sock kind of bubbly of the way the all that would've been so great. So like I noticed there was some of that, and obviously like you can't have a giant monster in your movie without stuff like that too. And it's just like it all felt very much in keeping with the tone, you know, and I think that's the most important thing. Nothing felt like it was like out of left field and trying.
No, it was very
that didn't feel natural.
I do think looking back now on the movie, I do think the one place that we all probably fumbled as a team, but I'll take it because I was at that time was when the grandmother turns into like the full vulture and she's chasing Sawa around
the necklace.
I just don't know if we, first of all, that scene with Devin in the warehouse where like you see his face and he's hiding, like we had like literally an hour to shoot that. It was scheduling got fucked up. We had spent too much time. We lost a day because our DP his COVID test was inconclusive. So we lost a full day of filming. I think if I had gone back and done the movie again, I maybe would have just had her in her clothes with hands and a face, because I feel like the whole body thing didn't work for some reason.
It felt like too much or something.
Well, I don't know if it's too much. It just, you know, it's like the monster at the end is the real thing. You know what I mean? Yeah, and Louis Kurtzman turning into, I love that transition scene when his face looks
stretching, very howling-y kind of like.
It looks like your concept.
Yeah, the
transformation.
So I think between Louis turning into that monster and then the monster at the end, we maybe should have spent a little more time with the Louis monster, because I feel like the angry grandmother character just kind of got lost in the shuffle.
It's okay. I mean, like, you know, we're having a real conversation. It's all right in the sense of, I was like, I literally was like, I wrote, oh shit, just when with the necklace.
Yeah.
But if that wasn't on her, if it wasn't on the, I would have, you know, would have been like, okay, he's kind of battling.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I actually had to fight for that shot. I had to fight for that shot because we were done editing the movie, and I was like, we need like a flashback to her necklace. And the producer
she
was
looks
like,
too different, and we didn't see her change. So it's
also
hard
not
to,
an
like,
important character. Like, not important. Yeah. It's not a recognizable person.
It's not like she'd been established, but it had been quite a while since we've seen
it. Exactly. There was too much time had passed. And I said to the producer, the producer and Andy were fighting me on that one. I said, how the fuck do you think the audience is going to know who that is? And they were like, well, it doesn't matter. I was like, it does because they had the confrontation and she said, I'll tear you apart or whatever. And you need to just sort of have a callback to that. That's a good instinct.
I think it made it work. Like, I think you really would have, had you not had that insert, it would have just felt like a mini boss. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It didn't have the connection at the beginning.
Like, who gives a shit?
That was your best callback in the sense, in like one of my movie pet peeves I say to my wife all the time is when we reach the end of a movie, and it usually happens in like rom-coms or whatever, where we give me a whole flashback of what they learned of the movie, you know, the scenes. Yeah. Like, yeah, I get it, I was there, that your time of that, that made sense, because I truly needed that reminder. So it would just been like, oh, he's battling an employee,
right?
And uh,
or a customer or whatever,
but since it was already connected to an established character.
It is a rare movie in this where I was, maybe it's because I like Bevan, was happy to see. It was like, I have some notes. It was like, oh shit, it was a fake out. He's alive. He's back. Because I truly thought, and maybe I'm naive for this, we did. Yo was like, okay, yeah, that's another sacrifice because that's how zombie movies.
No, I still, I felt like that it was in keeping with this. Felt like the type of movie where Devin Sawa could die.
So yeah, I thought he died.
That was a good fake out. Yeah, it worked
and,
on me.
Yeah, and then the whole thing between him and Brian and Bruce came on the roof like we took care of him.
Yeah.
I love it. Like, her being like, no, fuck off, and he's just sitting in the dumpster.
So great.
And then he tries to talk to him. Great comedy beat of talk to the kaiju type boss of and just bitch kicks
it's
him.
Funny because in the last episode because we were talking about Shea Whigham, we're talking about that great beat in Kong Skull Island where he tries to sacrifice himself and the thing just whips him into the mountain and I was eagerly anticipating, like, come on, here it comes. Yep, get a little closer. Yeah. You know what I mean? it was perfect. It was very good.
It's nice to see the, you adding in that end tag, though, of getting that clarity of, though, him and his kids and his wife. And
yeah,
I know we talked about earlier of, like, humanizing the characters and everything.
Great thing to have Devin. Like, it would have been could have had Devin sacrifice himself and or do like a big hero thing, but like now that he survived, he can actually learn from the thing that we saw happen to him in the, you know what I mean, he can actually take that lesson and maybe actually really change his life
now,
so it opens that up for that character. It makes you, it's nice, it's feel good.
I do have a question about that. Were you trying to build, was it just natural actor chemistry, or were you trying to build that, Isabella and, was Ivana. It Chris? I'm sorry, Ivana, not Isabella. Shit.
Yeah.
Were you trying to set them up to have chemistry to maybe, like, get together there and, like, Sawa to be, because I felt like, their scenes was more of a connection. And, like, Sawa then coming in, or was it just more of, like, we're going to get three of us?
I think that that's a lot of it's acting, and obviously Andy's writing, and I think that there was a relatability between Chris and Marnie, where they're kind of the same age, they're kind of dealing with this shitty job, and Ken's kind of just, like, this old fucking loser who, like...
Gotcha, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I was just, just kind of wondering, because it was like, oh, okay, like, maybe he's past watching movies of, like, that happened.
I thought that relationship was perfect, where it's like they all get along, they're all friends, and they like Ken, but Ken's the guy that, like, you like him and you laugh and you joke, and then he walks away, and the two younger characters would look at each other and kind of roll their eyes a little bit. You know
that's,
what I mean?
That's,
it's like they like Ken and everything.
That's me,
like,
to my,
Ken is also what he is, what he is. You know,
that's me to my coworkers. I know I'm the older guy that.
Hey, as long as they wait to roll their eyes till I walk away, that's all I care about.
No, it was just very, like, nice, and like you said, the you guys lucked out. Not, I don't want to say lucked out. You guys nailed it with the cast and the chemistry of the cast, because there's not one weak link. I watch, we watch movies from any budget, any way, and even if I love a movie, sometimes there's like, that wasn't great. That person wasn't great, but they loved the movie, and this one, I truly, honestly, didn't have that.
Well, a lot of times what happens is when earlier. Sorry, Brian, go ahead.
No, I was going to say the same thing we talked about earlier, like, some of the best movies, some of my favorite movies from the 90s have, like, just a killer character actor in every role. You know what I mean? Like, and everything is, like, just so tightly, and I feel like you're right. We've lost that now, where it's like everything's so focused on one central, one or two central actors, and then everybody else is kind of disposable.
Sure.
And we've lost that, like, nuance a little bit. And this one definitely had it, like, cast all the way down, top to bottom, was bringing heat. So.
Yeah, it's like all these movies Bruce made at the end of his career. Like, he would make all these cop movies where it was like him and then supporting cast of guys you kind of knew. You know what I mean? It's like if you took whatever Bruce Willis was getting paid and spread that out over the four main actors, like, look at how fucking amazing. And I know Gerard Butler is the big bankable star. But look at how amazing Den of Thieves was, because that whole cast, that whole
was Anthony Mackie was in that. I think.
No, it was Butler and Pablo Schreiber and and what's his name? Ice Cube's son. I forget his first
name. Oh, O'Shea.
O'Shea Jackson Jr.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure Jerry got a huge payday for that movie, but when you get to fill it with other amazing actors, you know, if it's just Jerry Butler and a bunch and like five other guys you don't really know, do you have the same movie?
I love that.
I don't think so.
I love that point. Just because I watch, and you see the quality. I for the most part, I think I've probably watched 98.5% of Nicolas Cage's catalog, you know, from good to bad. It's the same thing as your Bruce Willis example of sometimes there are these movies where they fill them with notable actors and the movie is better than you would expect what you hit play on. And then other times it's not.
Well, the other thing too is like, so a perfect example, and this is on my kids' lives, this is 100% true. So what happened to Devin and I is, I wrote this script and I sent it to him and he was like, this is awesome, let's do it. And we started putting the movie together and we had a budget number and we started going out and all these agents and studios were like, what about this actor? What about this actor? And Devin and I were like, you're just asking us to cast these people because they're bankable. Like Devin was adamant of, Devin was sending me lists of like all these fucking incredible character actors. We were like, how amazing would this movie be if we had this guy and this guy and this girl? You know what I mean? Like, they just want to throw Bruce Willis or Ron Perlman, who's amazing. They're all amazing.
They just want to sell it. They know that person and say, you give them that money, they do it. I know the conversation's got a little offhanded. Me and my wife have been watching, just finished up Righteous Gemstones, one of our favorite shows. Mm-hmm. And, Eric Roberts is in the, you know, is in the second season. And it's literally the only actor Flyover Channel has been offered to, like, interview for a thing from one of those random sites.
Yeah.
And my wife was asking, I said, oh, no, you recognize him. He's been in, like, 500 things. Like, his IMDb is, I think, has to be a top 10 most per people.
Yeah.
And she's like, huh. And I go, but I can't tell you except for, like, two movies, and I know you haven't seen them, what that man has been in.
Right.
You know.
Well, it's like you go back and you look at the cast of Con Air. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
it's my all-time favorite.
Every fucking incredible actor in the world. And I think, you know, a lot of times, some of these actors see these, and I get it, they see these movies as their job and it's a business. So it's like, I think every A-list Oscar winner is in Oppenheimer because they all want to work with Chris Nolan. And they're all probably making like $100,000 each because you can't pay 15 actors, $5-10 million each.
It's I was just thinking the same thing about Asteroid City's getting ready to come out. And I was like, you know, Tom Hanks took up, like, didn't get his Tom Hanks money to be in Asteroid City.
He wants to be in the Wes
Anderson movie. He wants to be in a Wes Anderson movie,
But and a lot of times, what has to happen is you have to have a script that actors will read and go, oh, I would fucking love to do this. You know, it's like, my buddy Kevin Chapman, he's another Boston actor. He's a great character actor. He was in Unstoppable. He was in Mystic River. He was in Ladder 49 with Travolta. And there's two scripts of mine that he read. He was like, we got to get these movies made. And it's like, who can we go out to? Like, he worked with Jason Clark on the
I know TV who that show is.
He worked with Jason Clark on the TV show Brotherhood. Maybe we go out to Jason. Like, okay, so can we get Chappie and Jason Clark and Devin and maybe one other actor, because you want to fill these movies with and listen, most actors are incredible, but when you can get actors that everybody loves, it's like, that's what I tried to do with Black Friday. People fucking love Bruce. Everybody loves Devin. They love Ivana. They fucking love Michael. You know what I mean? So it's like, why not try
to get... Even people who aren't, like, in the know, who don't know everybody's names, you have, like, what we used to refer to as that guy actors, people who make you go, oh, it's that guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, one of my favorites I think of all the time is Tombstone. Like, top to bottom, cast out the ass with, like, Powers Booth and Michael Biehn and Michael Rooker. No, like, every
fucking
role
Billy Bob Thornton's in Tombstone.
Billy Bob Thornton has, like, two scenes. He just breezes through. Jason Priestley and Billy Zane. And, like, every role is filled. Like, it's
incredible.
Don't do it like that anymore.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, I love the point. It's true, and sometimes those actors then end up breaking out, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I used to feel like that's who you used to look at as like Sam Rockwell, right? Used to be in all this stuff and be like, it's that guy.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the guy breaks out.
Yeah, and the worst part about that for being a filmmaker is, you know, I think, I don't know if it was before Black Friday or after Black Friday. I was talking to somebody in finance, and I had mentioned Melanie Lynskey, and they were like, "Oh, she can't get a movie finance." And I was like,
"Really?"
I was, "Well, maybe she can, but it's
maybe
like
now she's having a moment.
She probably can.
She's having a moment
but here's
now."
Here's the thing. I said to the finance person, I was like, "Dude, she's incredible, and people fucking love her." And now she's on Yellow Jackets. Now she's in The Last of Us. And it's like, see? You know what I mean?
You could have been on the ground floor of that.
Yeah.
Just, there's a lot of incredible actors out there who fans and people who love movies love, but financing people don't see that, because making a movie is like putting on a rock concert, okay? It's like, if you want to have a birthday party and you rent out Giant Stadium, you have to hire Elton John or Guns N' Roses. You can't have, like, you know, who's a smaller, like, can't have Queens of the Stone Age. Queens of the Stone Age won't fill Giant Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
You need U2 or the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
So when you go make a movie, these people want to know that this actor is going to put asses in the seats. They put Bruce Willis on a straight to video DVD. It's going to get rented from Redbox. It's going to get rented online. And that's why a lot of the times it sucks when you're trying to cast a movie, because you want to have incredible actors that you love or people that you want to see on screen. And a lot of these financiers go, no, they're not. They're not going to get us.
That's super that unfortunate, insightful, and it. I mean, unfortunately, it makes sense when you put it the way you put it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess before
I think the more projects too, like because of streaming services, because there's so much more stuff just being produced too. You know, so like you're stretched. You know, the it's stretched thin. Those great actors, it's hard to pull them in. One's on a show, one's already working here, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you can't even get those guys together.
The model has changed a little bit too, and I think that you've heard Anthony Mackie brought it up, Tarantino brought it up, I think Matt Damon recently. It's like, if you want to go and you want to make this super intense artistic movie and your budget is, you know, $30 million or whatever, and you want Chris Evans to be the lead, a lot of people may say, well, people only know him as Captain America. And I think the same thing may go for Henry Cavill. Like, people know him as Superman, you know? Yeah. But maybe you put them both in a movie, maybe that works. I think there's a handful of people that can get movies financed. You know, Brad Pitt, Ben Affleck, DiCaprio, Tom Cruise, you know, Clooney, Jennifer Lawrence. But you know, it changes generationally too, because it was Julia Roberts forever. Then it was Reese Witherspoon. Then it was Jennifer Lawrence. Now it's kind of like Sydney Sweeney, you know, and there's other actors. There's like people that are incredibly well respected, like Viola Davis or Jess Chastain. And it's like, you put them in a movie, it most likely gets financed, but maybe you need both of them. So it's like, it's a real pain in the ass to figure out the finances and who's worth what, and it's you have to make compromises sometimes, and it sucks.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not just what the consumer sees, and then there's more to it, and completely.
No, and if you're lucky enough to get a studio backed film or a franchise film or whatever, you can sort of cast. So it's like, I have a buddy who works at Sony, and he was like, you know, take a look at the Sony catalog and see what, you know, see what they made and if anything would be up for a remake. And it's like, you see all these movies. Okay. Mm-hmm. So one Sony movie. I don't know if they own it anymore, but Sony Columbia did The Running Man. Okay, so it's like,
I love The Running Man.
It's incredible. It's an incredible movie. So there was, if you went to remake that, I would assume that you have to get Chris Hemsworth or someone.
Oh, like, well, that. It would need to fill the shoes of Arnold, you know. So yeah, Hemsworth, yeah. Or
right,
whatever. You would not,
yeah, big,
you would not do,
yeah.
You know,
nobody's gonna agree like that without somebody who can carry the movie. Like, they
do The Running Man with Pete Davidson, you know, like it wouldn't work. No. There, even if you were like, I got this guy attached, everyone loves him.
Burn. No, but Chris is now also doing his second Extraction movie, which is on Netflix. Yeah. So you're gonna get some financiers and distributors who go, well, he's doing Netflix movies. How do I know that he's going to sell tickets in fucking Germany? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, to bring it back just a little bit, and I'd rather end on a higher note than just how hard it is to make.
Yeah.
What's something, I guess this is a cliche, like, what was like the all-time scene and like comparatively day of making Black Friday, and then at the same time, if we have time, what's something you would have liked to add to it as well?
Think that's a. I'm gonna bifurcate this answer.
Yeah, that's good. I'm just trying to get us back on.
I have two things. One is serious, and one is funny.
Okay.
Not to slight any of the other actors, because I love them all, and I still talk to most of them. To walk in and see Bruce Campbell in a makeup chair, and he saw me walk in, and he goes, "Mr. Tebow," and I was like, "Holy fuck, that's Bruce Campbell!" Mm-hmm. Like, that was a big one for me. The day that we did the Breakfast Club scene, where I just got to see these actors, just really, you know, aside from the jokes and the zombies and the whatever, to really see them just shine at their craft, and everybody who sees that scene is like, well, that's the best scene in the movie. I'm like, well, yeah, it's very serious. And then my other favorite part of Black Friday was, I think, like, day two or three, and I went to craft services to get like a coffee or something, and the catering girl was like, she's like, oh, I'm Jessica. And I was like, oh, I'm Casey. And she's like, oh, are you the gaffer? And I was like, just because, like, I'm a big guy and I wear like Carhartt stuff, you know what I mean? Like, that's just very New England. They thought I was like, and I'm like, no, I'm the director. Well, it's fine. And she was like, she turned bright red. She's like, I'm so sorry.
And then, of course,
you had her fired, though, right?
Yeah.
Right away.
I mean, you got the stereotypical, once again, we always mean this lovingly, that masshole kind of just like cadence to, you know. Yeah, and then you were.
No, like, and then if I would have added anything, Joe Lynch said to me, he said, I loved your movie. He goes, but I hated the fact that you didn't have enough extras. And because of COVID, we had literally like one day with like 20 people. And, you know, this is Black Friday. There's like it breaks my heart. It is what it is. We shot it literally before vaccines. When Chris is walking over with the mop and bucket, and he sees that pile of like viscera, yeah, and he pulls the ball cage over and knocks that dude out, like, it's a different movie if there's dozens and dozens of people running around in that scene, because it adds to the intensity.
Chaos. Yeah, I like that you brought that back around, because I'm now remembering another question I had. Like, it has actually with the music. I know it's a different a few years later with the music, which I love that intro, right? It's that Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead kind of intro you did.
Patrick Stump from Fallout Boy did all the music, by the way.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. It's another New England. That's new. They're New England, correct?
No, he's from Chicago.
Okay. I feel like my wife would hit me in the back of my head messing that one up. But, you know, it's like Krampus, like that intro to Krampus, right? Which is Black Friday also.
Yeah.
And they're rushing through. And I mean, you captured the vibe at best you did, but understanding that you filmed this during COVID too.
Yeah.
I think adds that element to be like, oh yeah, but you did still work with having that crowd.
Yeah.
And I more took it also as the crowds on Black Friday at midnight are dwindling down, especially if we're supposed to be, you know, like I drive out every year. Actually, I think I'm going to stop this year for Blu-ray sales. Cause that's like when it's like, I literally have a list of like, oh, that's WB movie. That'll be $8 on Black Friday. You know, like I haven't seen it, but I physical collector, Brian, like blah, blah, blah. So that's how I read it more as, is the not so much you didn't have this.
It's more like diehards are out. You know what I mean?
There's a midnight release. and it's not 2009.
Yeah.
I also, the other comment, first comment I had is nature of what I do is, love the font choices in the intro, of,
the titles, you know,
the title credits and everything. Yeah. I thought it was very, very fun.
We had something much more elaborate. I wanted to do a checkout conveyor belt and have, there's this guy online. His name's, Readful Things, I think.
He makes, oh, yes, yes.
Oh, incredible. Amazing. I wanted to have him make action figures of the cast, and we were going to have it scanned.
Cool. Oh.
But we didn't have the money, so.
That would have been. Should have done it for free.
right.
Come on, man. Just donate your time and effort.
Hey, if you need a much lesser graphic designer, man,
sure.
I can figure some stuff out.
Okay, no problem.
Sounds
good.
But,
are there any, did we miss anything? Are there any other stories or gory details you wanted to share with us or the public before we, did we wring all the good stuff out of you yet?
did we satisfy the Black Friday conversation that you were hoping to have?
Yeah, I think we did. We talked about everything. We covered everything. You know, it was a difficult movie to make. We shot during COVID, and then Chris Tonic, my editor, and I, he was editing, and then he would send me. It was not traditionally edited. We didn't sit together and do it. And Chris is an incredible editor. He had just come off of being first assistant editor on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Suicide Squad. Yeah, so Chris has incredible pedigree, and if he's available, he'll edit the rest of my movies. But you know, we had to like send clips back and forth because of COVID. Yeah. It was a fucking real racket for sure.
Yeah, no, that like said, so, like that make that. It's so impressive. It adds another wrinkle in not realizing, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it gets extra points for being a movie made during the pandemic that doesn't have to tell us it's being made during the pandemic.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
It's talking about new pet peeves.
It's timeless. I'll tell you what, it's getting to the point where you watch a COVID movie now and it's already so passe. You're like, oh, God. As soon as you see somebody in a mask, you're like, all right, so it's a COVID movie.
Oh, you just said it. We were just watching Gemstones. The Reese watch. Completely forgot they reference in season two COVID multiple times. I mean, thankfully, you know, they don't show everything, but it was like, oh. I'm 2 years out of it now. I don't find that as funny anymore.
Exactly.
Kudos, it's already passé. Kudos to that. And the other thing I want to add is, I didn't say it in the beginning, your hat fucking rules.
Oh, thanks.
The Nostromo.
I love it.
Brian's like the biggest Alien fan, I think. Maybe.
What was that, Brian?
I didn't want to bring up the stuff I read about on IMDb because I didn't, you know, the accuracy and your privacy. But I know I know you're a fan from what I read.
No, I did. I named my daughter Ripley, and she doesn't give a fuck about Alien. All she wants to talk about is Taylor Swift. So,
her and my wife.
It's a cool name, regardless. You know what I mean? Like,
Very cool. But yeah, Casey, always I really appreciate it. You know, come on anytime. I appreciate you having you.
Yeah.
Joe, you said we were going to do plugs.
I know we didn't. So Casey, tell us where we could find you and everywhere. Like I said, I've been following you on Twitter for a couple of years now.
And you're such a
pleasant and fun follow.
Twitter, I think it's Casey Shoots, and I think my Instagram is Casey Patrick Tebow. Maybe I don't know.
I'll put your links.
If you Google my name, most of the socials come up. I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So that's it. I don't really have anything else to plug.
Perfect. Yeah, watch Black Friday. It's on Stars. It's available for rental. We don't review here, but it is very truly enjoyable.
Yeah, and my first movie, Happy Birthday, is on, yes. I think it's on Amazon and iTunes.
I'd like to check that out,
Happy Birthday. Yeah, you'll see Steven Tyler with, like, a crazy beard and, like, a robe, and, you know,
I was reading a little bit about it because I was, you know, like I said, we're just to get looking at the IMDb, and I was, like, immediately, like, oh, I wish I had time to watch that one before this, too.
Yeah. It's so funny, I was looking up something on Rotten Tomatoes, and Bloody Disgusting did like the most incredible review of Happy Birthday. They were like, this is a cinematic gift wrapped up in an indie Mexican thriller. And I was like, hey, fucking A.
That's, you know what we want.
Like, yeah. I'm going to get that
tattooed on me. Damn. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can we put this in print?
Yeah, for sure.
That's red.
Awesome. But yeah, thank you again. And, stay frightful, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to Flyover State of Fear.